forests. She talks about the beauty of trees, what makes them live and thrive, and the terrible threat that many trees are facing both here and abroad. Monday's morning show begins just after 8.
This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that focuses on the concerns in the Tri-County area. It's hosted by Jane Herring, Marcia Connett, Joan Rory, and Ron Purty. Community Matters also shares its time slot with the 32-time award-winning WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's host.
Good morning and welcome to Community Matters. I'm Jane Herring. I have spent the last week or so raiding the greenhouses and digging in our gardens, and I'm guessing many of you are doing the same. Some are new to gardening, and some of you may have been gardening for decades. What I do know for sure is that all who are interested in gardening or landscape can learn something from our guest today. Vijay Pandian is the horticulture educator for Racine and Kenosha counties through the University of Wisconsin-Madison Division of Extension. So, Vijay, welcome to the program. Thanks for coming with us today.
Thanks for inviting me, Jane.
It's just kind of the perfect time to talk with you because I think everybody, now that the sun is shining and we're getting a little bit better weather, we're really getting serious about starting our planting season. And I guess I wanted to start with the fact that I know for me, this is the latest I've had my tomatoes in the ground in probably 5 years. So how does kind of a cooler spring affect planting? Does it?
Well, on certain crops, it does, actually. You know, we have this kind of notion, like, you know, many people around Memorial Day weekend, we start planting some warm season crops like tomatoes, peppers, zucchinis, pumpkins even, actually. And, you know, but lately, you know, the spring weather seems to be, you know, very bizarre. It's been fluctuating back and forth. Certain days we're getting about 70 degree, and certain times we're getting about 50 to 55 degree. And many tropical type of crops, like warm season crops, like tomatoes, peppers, you know, they don't like this type of, you know, fluctuating weather, especially this chilly weather. And so gardeners need to be a little bit more patient in those cases, because for many warm season crops, they need to have an average about, like, you know, 65 to 70 degree daytime temperature. At night temperature should not be not less than 60 degree. And the soil temperature also matters a lot. They also need to be warm up a little bit. So they need to get at least about 55 to 60 degrees. So we don't have that right now. So gardeners need to be a bit more patient, hoping that the warm weather coming up pretty soon, maybe next week or so. Once it warms up, you know, then you can able to plant it. If not, many of these tomatoes and peppers, they're going to simply sit in the ground. They're not going to grow anything. And they're going to start to see some signs like cold injury damage by leaves turning a little bit wilty in appearance, sometimes discoloration, like especially peppers, they turn into purple in color. So those are some signs of some like cold injury type of thing. Thank God we didn't have a frost here, but in places like northern part of Wisconsin, they might, I know. So in those kind of situation, the best option is to use some floating row cover. Floating row cover is a polyester spunbond material. You can drape it on the top of the plant. It gives you about like 5 degree of warmthness to the plant. So you set it, actually, you know, either you can put up a frame around the plant, or maybe you can just drape it on the top of the plant in the late in the evening hours, and then the morning you can take it back again. Sometimes, you know, to give a little bit more extra protection, some people use a double layer, which can give you about 5 to 10 degree of warmness. And those are some temporary ways and a to protect your plant from cold temperature, especially if the temperature, night temperature drops to 50 degrees or less than that. And to warm up your soil temperature too, there are a lot of easiest way to do. I mean, people love to go, nowadays people love to do raised bed gardening. raised bed gardening tend to warm up the soil much quicker. But if you want to speed up the warming process, all you have to do is they take a black plastic sheet, either if you have a black, garbage bags or something like that. You just lay it actually on the ground and then make sure you seal the edges by adding some dirt or have a wooden lath to it. And let it actually stay there for a week. You will start to see the temperature starting rising up very quickly to about 70 degrees. Say, oftentimes people do ask me question, how do you measure your soil temperature? It's very simple. Take a meat cooking thermometer, stick it in the ground, wait for 30 seconds, and then you can able to know. Say, again, the key thing is that for many warm season crops, you need to have a soil temperature of 55 to 60 degrees, okay? And a night temperature should not drop below 60 degrees. And day temperature about like 65, 70 degrees are good for many warm season crops.
It has been tough to get that night temperature at 60 or above. It's been in the 50s for the most part. Maybe next week.
Maybe next week. I mean, a lot of time, many plants simply sit in the ground till about like mid-June to late June, because, the temperature has to stabilize in Wisconsin, Only in late June, they start to produce some more foliage. You will start to see some more growth and activities happen. Then, for example, like pumpkins and sweet potatoes, they need some more extra warm weather. They need a soil temperature of 70 degrees, and we don't get that 70 degrees only like the first week in July or something like that. Only by then they will start to see some more growth in it.
It is kind of interesting because some of the even just the flowers, not only the vegetables, you can see they're kind of clinging down close to the ground because they just it's just been too chilly for them to rise up as high as they normally do.
Absolutely. The other thing is that when the temperature is a bit cold, plants do not absorb those nutrients. So you won't see that much of growth and activity happens, during the cold temperature. So gardeners need to be more patient about it as well. Don't actually add too much fertilizer because it's going to be waste. And plus, especially when it's going to rain, most of those nutrients are going to get leached out as well too. Say, make sure that, let things warm up a little bit. At the same time, gardeners, don't be very hasty in applying mulch. Because the soil needs to warm up. Mulch, there are two purposes for adding mulch. One, to conserve the moisture. Other thing is to cool the soil. And generally, mulch is used during in the summertime when it gets hot and dry because, you need to have more of conserving the moisture at the same time cooling the root system. Now the soil is already cold, so adding mulch is going to further delay the warming up process. Be a little bit more patient in this.
Okay, that's like the fourth time you've used that patience word. That's something that we are not really good at.
You can also count me in too because we have a very short growing season, we've been waiting for such a long time actually to do this gardening, But the other thing you can do is that you can plant cool season crops. Say broccolis, cauliflower, cabbage, kohlrabi, potatoes, onions, leek. These are some cool season crops. They can take this kind of cold weather very easily. So if you're one of those gardeners, you want to get started right away, probably, you can plant this cool season crop right now in the ground as well as in raised beds or in containers. You can also use some leafy greens like from, leafy lettuce, spinach, all those things can also be seeded right now as well too.
So that can calm people down so they can just show the patience for those warm weather crops. I was surprised to see my potatoes were sprouting. I have them in bags and they were doing their things despite nothing else really doing its thing. So good advice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about perennials. I know I enjoy talking about vegetables, and we'll probably come back to that. But as far as perennials, we've been hearing so much about butterfly gardens and pollinators, and sometimes, especially when you have vegetable crops, you need those earlier pollinators. But can you give me a little bit of an idea about how you could plan a garden so that you can attract bees and butterflies early all the way through the growing season to support all of those crops that need pollination?
Well, for pollinators, you need to create a suitable habitat for them. You know, either for the pollinators, you know, to collect the pollens and nectar, or for to rear their, you know, young larvae, you need to provide a suitable habitat for them. And our landscape could be turned to a habitat. One thing, for example, if you do have a very good sunny patch area, you could turn that one into native prairie garden, or you can have a butterfly garden where you plant some lot of native prairie species. And some of the native ones, you know, that usually tend to bloom a little bit earlier, you know, probably in late May, like golden Alexander, spiderwort, you know, those are plants can be planted. The other thing I would also suggest is that if you do have a lot of lawn, make sure, you know, don't spray them, you know, in springtime. You know, I know it's easy for me to say, but, you know, sometimes if you spray any insecticides and stuff like that, that could deter these pollinators from, you know, collecting the pollens nearby the pollinator garden area. So, you have to be very careful, you know, what you're going to spray in your lawn. And the second thing also, it's also going to be beneficial for vegetable garden too, you know, especially when you have a garden next to a lawn, you don't want to have any kind of spray drift affecting your vegetable garden as well too. The other thing you can also do it to enhance, you know, your pollinators, you know, getting into your vegetable garden is that many of these pollinators, you know, do like some massive planting, so massive colors. So plant them in a large numbers of the same color. Say, and that will give them like a showstop for them to stop by. Hey, I got a, you know, bunch of this, you know, yellow pollen kind of thing, so they can actually group them and, you know, do their pollen and collect the nectars as well too. Those could be also, you know, help those pollinators to navigate into your garden beds, you know, having this kind of massive planting as well too. The other thing you may want to also think about, you know, in terms of attracting the pollinators is also to have some, you know, old wooden logs. Sometimes, you know, if you see cut down any trees or anything like that, you can save those wooden logs and drill some holes into it of varying sizes and stuff. And those holes will be excellent for those native pollinators to rear some of their young ones in those things. So again, you know, you may think that, oh my God, you know, my lawn is not pristine. But again, those kind of wooden logs provide actually some suitable habitat for them, you know. So those are some key things that you can consider actually in turning your landscape into pollinator friendly, which is going to help in your vegetable garden as well too. For example, pumpkins, squashes, you know, they do need pollinators for pollination purpose.
It was kind of interesting. One of the city gardens that I take care of, you know, used to get a ton of zucchini, and there had been, I know, some construction nearby, but all of a sudden, I just can't really get it to, it must not be getting pollinated because you get the fruit that just kind of rots on the vine. It isn't growing. And for people to not get enough zucchini, you know, usually you have a ton of it and you're trying to get rid of it. So I assume that that's part of the issue is lack of pollination.
Yeah, lack of pollination could be one of the factors that affects the, you know, your zucchini, squashes, winter squashes, or even pumpkins, you know. Usually winds and bees, they help in pollination, do the cross-pollination for these kind of plants. If you don't have enough of them, probably they're not going to produce that much of crop as well. Same thing with the small fruits too, like for example, from blueberries to raspberries, you know, bees and other pollinators helps a lot actually in producing more crops. So again, you know, if you do want to have, bountiful crops of vegetables as well as, you know, your small fruits, definitely having a little bit of a pollinator-friendly garden nearby attracts them. Being and living in an urban area, sometimes it's hard to get some of these pollinators, you know, so I think it is one of the nice way to do. Yeah.
I was fascinated when you were talking about the logs, and I know this isn't a program that's about bees necessarily, but that I think a lot of people think of some kind of a honeycomb that's set aside somewhere, and that's bees happily go back to their honeycomb. But they have a lot of places where they're nesting, correct?
Absolutely. You know, some of the native bees do nest actually in the ground, underneath the ground. So sometimes, you know, if you do have a small pile of, you know, mulch or maybe leftover leaf materials collected from last fall, or even a little bit of in a compost piles, okay, they could also be providing a habitat for some of the native ones as well. Sometimes if you cut down any of those trees and some of those log materials, when you pile them up, that could also provide them, you know, to further enhance it. That's why I said to drill some holes into those cross section of the wooden pile. That could also provide a good suitable habitat for them. Now, if you do need some pretty nice garden and looking very nice, not with all these things, you know, maybe what you can also do is that, you know, you can purchase like, you know, bee motels. Nowadays, actually, if you go Amazon and other things, they have all these bamboo sticks actually piled up together in a neatly artsy craft thing. And that can be also installed in your garden too, if you want to look a little more aesthetically, you know, nice. The other thing, you know, you can do is that you can also create a small puddle and put some water to it, some put some gravel to it, so these butterflies can also hang around and rest around those puddle areas as well too. Again, if you don't like to see those puddles and stuff like that, probably you can also get a lot of this artsy, crafty, you know, bowl or something like that, shallow pane. And then you can also set it in the ground and fill some water to it in a little bit shaded area, so the butterfly during the summertime can actually, you know, lay around to it as well too. So,
you know, you kind of bring up a point, is aesthetics versus doing the right thing for the environment. And sometimes you drive around and you see people who have a pretty wild-looking yard. Let's leave it at that. I mean, it's kind of a mess, but are they doing the right thing for the environment? Does it make sense in an urban area to do that? What can you do to look nice and still be kind to animals?
Well, the very first thing is that, in a check with your local village or the city on the ordinance. I mean, that's very important. You know, every cities and all, you know, local villages, they have ordinance, you know, especially in the front yard, in a how tall your grass can be, how tall your plant can be, you know, some from 9 inches to something like that. So check with them first, actually, you know, you need to follow the regulations. And second of all, in a, again, in a, you also have to be very cognizant about some of those, you know, in the name of wildflowers, sometimes you may actually accidentally introduce some invasive plants as well too. So be careful about it. Some of the invasive ones can be look pretty, like for example, Creeping Charlie. You know, we all have Creeping Charlie. And again, you know, it's a very invasive plant. It can displace, you know, other native plants as well. So just be careful about those invasive plants when you go, if you accidentally introduce some, take steps right away to remove those things, okay? Second, the third thing, probably, you know, you also have to be very cognizant. Sometimes, you know, when you do have a lot of these native prairie plants, we don't actually do that need that much maintenance in terms of, like, you know, cleaning up them, you know, early in the springtime, and the debris accumulate. But sometimes when you have that much a pile of debris, you know, accumulate, it can also attract some rodents actually as well too, you know. And so especially in city areas, you know, when you, especially in your front yard, I would do some cleanup in the springtime just to deter some of those rodents, okay. So these are some of the, you know, things that you can do to maintain your yard a little bit cleany, at the same time be more environmental friendly as well too.
You mentioned invasive plants, and I think people automatically think of garlic mustard and buckthorn, you know, kind of out in the nature areas that start to take over an area and push out, I don't want to say good plants, but some of the other natives. But I can say I'm very guilty of having gone to, you know, perennial sales or whatever, and coming back with, for instance, a bellflower. I can't remember the type of bellflower, but oh my gosh, it just took over everything and got rid of some of my favorite perennials. There's others like that, right?
Absolutely. You know, creeping bellflower that you said, snow on the mountain, you know, we call it Bishop's Goutby, you know, was once actually been used as a ground cover. I mean, it's one of the most aggressive one. There are some perennials which you have to be very careful about it, you know, what you're going to introduce in your garden. And speaking of that too, you know, many people are also aware about the jumping worm as well too. You know, when you're going to shop and get from your friends, or when you go for a plant sale thing, you know, organized by your local garden clubs, you know, we don't know what type of, you know, invasive worms that you're going to bring in to your garden as well too. So there are a lot of, you know, risk involved into those kind of things. But again, be more cautious about it, you know, check your plants. You know, Wisconsin DNR has a great list of invasive species that you should avoid, and you can take a look at those list of invasive species one, you know, and especially also in the aquatic section too. So a lot of time people have water features. And sometimes many garden centers do some aquatic plants, and we are not sure which one is suitable or not. So if you are that kind of person, you know, go to the Wisconsin DNR. They have a list of species. Double check that before you shop for them. Yeah.
Yeah, and I wish I would have known about that resource 5-6 years ago, because, boy, just about every mistake that could be made, I've pretty much made it. And then you spend the next 5 years digging out your mistakes, where you could certainly save time and energy by doing the research first. And certainly VJ and your expertise in the Master Gardener program is a great way of learning where to look to get that kind of information, for sure. You had mentioned blueberries earlier, and I know you're very much into the different types of fruits that you can grow at home that perhaps people thought they couldn't grow here. And I've gone to a couple of your blueberry workshops, and I've been having some really good crops the last 3 years in my container blueberries. Maybe you want to start with talking about that, and then some of the other tests on fruits that you're doing out at the Kenosha County Center.
Yeah, say one of the program that we're doing is actually about exploring some of the antioxidant-rich small fruits. There are many small fruit crops which are very rich in antioxidants and can be easily grown in our home landscape. I mean, blueberry is one of the most popular one, and of course, you know, we don't have the soil, right soil for it. But still, you can able to grow blueberries, you know, either in a trench or in a raised beds or in a container. And you basically, you're going to use a soilless media for blueberries that's going to stabilize your soil pH is peat, pine bark, you know, you mix some 1:1 ratio and sprinkle some elemental sulfur, and then you plant your blueberry. And so that is a key ingredient, actually, to support your blueberry plant. And then once in a month, you fertilize it, you know, using some miracid type of fertilizer. And that way you can be able to grow blueberries. Now, there are other small fruit crops. You know, some people may think this is too much for them to maintain it. You know, if that is the case, there are other small fruit crops, you know, which is also rich in antioxidant, which is also sweet in taste. One is like, you know, you can also try a currant called Black Claw Crandall Currant, Black Claw Crandall Currant. And this has a more sweet and sour taste to it. It can be planted any type of soil. All it needs is a full sun. It has a gorgeous fall fall coloration on the leaf. And by midsummer, it produces kind of like a blackberries, which are sweet and sour taste to it. Now, you can also try honeyberries. You know, honeyberries are one of the first fruit crops, you know, that produces in late May. And it has a little bit more, you know, stringent taste to it, or maybe more tarty taste to it. You can also try that. And it's not very picky about the soil, so you can plant them in the hedges. One of my favorite one would be the Pixel Gooseberry. Pixel is an amazing one, which is very vigorous and high productive. All it needs a full sun, least maintenance, I would say. The berries, in a minute, but choose by late June. They are very sweet in taste. Unlike many gooseberries, you know, which are very, stringent one, you know. But this one, Pixel, is a really nice one. It doesn't have that kind of stringent characteristic. There's more sweet in taste to it. You can try that. Of course, we always have strawberries. Strawberries are more easier to grow. And say, get a June-bearing strawberries, you know. There are a lot of different varieties of June-bearing strawberries, which will last till about 5 years. So these are some of the, you know, alternate crops that you can try, you know, if you have tough time growing blueberries in a soilless media, you can try these things.
You had mentioned the strawberries. Now, some people have had the experience where once you plant that in the ground, it like takes over again, sort of as a ground cover. Have you had much luck in having either a separate raised bed or growing them in containers?
So we had it in a raised bed and gosh, for 3 years or 4 years in a row, I never even did anything to it, honestly, and it is like growing itself naturally. I mean, yes, of course, that's one of the biggest advantage. We had a bigger raised bed, about 8 feet by 8 feet. We planted this, you know, June-bearing strawberries, like Cavendish and stuff, and, you know, it took over the entire bed. But, you know, it didn't actually send any runners beyond the raised bed. Say, I mean, every month of June, we harvest those berries. And so we had a better luck in growing in raised beds, you know, one. And you can also try in containers, but the thing is that if you want to try in a containers one, try some of the ones, actually, that are day-neutral type of strawberries. Which needs to be replanted every year. They might be best suitable in container one, okay? But if it's in ground or in raised bed, try the June-bearing types.
Okay. Now, that sounds good advice. You had mentioned a lot of different, like the Pixel Gooseberry. How large of a space would a plant take up?
So we had it in our raised beds, in fact, you know, this Pixel one, and it didn't take that much space, about 2 feet or 3 feet by 3 feet at the very maximum, you know, for one plant.
Does it go up very high?
No, not so much. It has more of a little bit of a mounding characteristic may be about like in a foot and a half at the very maximum. The only disadvantage of the pixel gooseberry is that it has spines in it. So that'll be the only disadvantage. So you can plant them in the edges of your fences and stuff like that, you know, if that needed to be, if that is a concern for you guys, you know, so you can try that.
It might keep some of the marauding wildlife away from them, though, too. Mm-hmm. Although, didn't you have birds attack your was it, no, those were the honeyberries.
Honeyberries, not the gooseberries one. You know?
Good. you were talking about the blueberries, the gooseberries, and you didn't really mention raspberries. And I know... sometimes, like when I moved into my home 38, 39 years ago, there was a raspberry bush, and all of its little relatives have continued to grow in this spot that would be rather unlikely, but I get some, you know, a good amount of raspberries out of it. Is there an optimal way of maintaining that, of taking care of your raspberry bushes?
Well, in my opinion, I mean, and based on my demonstration trial, raspberries are pretty much a little bit of a maintenance, high maintenance crop in a way that, you know, once you plant them, you do need to properly train and prune them. And if you fail to train them, they will take over the entire bed very easily. It doesn't matter if it's a raised bed or in ground. So one of the way we tried in a raised bed is that at least, you know, we can able to contain it, you know, but still those canes suck us out quite easily. And say there are certain ways you can able to build a trellis system for them to train it. So we do have an extension publication that talks in detail, so homeowners can download this publication online. Just Google up growing raspberry UW extension, and you will able to download this publication that talks about growing raspberries. And in that, they will talk about in detail about how do you train them and prune them as well. Now, if you do want to get a raspberry, get a yellow-bearing raspberry or fall-bearing raspberry. And the reason is that fall-bearing raspberry, they start producing slowly in August and goes till about the first frost. The pruning operation is very simple, only by like late fall or very early in the springtime, you cut all the canes down to the ground. And so that is the easiest way of pruning, you know, the fall-bearing one compared to the summer-bearing raspberries. Now, in raspberries, you know, we do have an infection called spotted winged drosophila, which is an invasive fruit fly. So you don't want to let those raspberries to completely mature or ripen. So harvest them before it's completely fully ripens. So in that way, you can protect those berries. I mean, you know, even if you do, get those spotted drosophila, invasive fruit fly, still you can eat it, but some people find it very uneasy about it. Some of the best one I find actually, in terms of the varieties for fall bearing is Heritage. Then there is a yellow one called Fall Gold, which is, tastes like a candy. So these are some of the varieties you can try. Again, when you think about raspberry, be careful. They can easily overtake the garden. So better you find a way, how do you better to train and prune them, you know. If not, don't protect it.
No, and it's good advice and a good reminder that the UW Extension does have a number of resources that you can download, information pieces. And so if you have a question, you can Google that. How else does the UW Extension help gardeners in our communities?
Well, you know, people can reach us out, by either dropping an email or by calling us, go to the local, extension's website, and you can able to find the information or contact info as well. Or you can, in Kenosha and Racine County, you can stop by at the Kenosha County Center in Bristol, and, you know, you can drop the samples. You know, if you have any garden-related type of things, you can drop the sample. We do have an arboretum, so you can also take a walk in the arboretum as well, too. It's open for public 24/7, you know, so.
And I did want to talk in a little bit greater detail about the arboretum, because I think it's something people have no clue is out there, for one thing, because it's relatively new. You've been working very hard on it the last few years. But it's a pretty much of a mile loop of trees. But it's not just any tree. You're actually using it as a test site, correct?
Absolutely. See, we started this arboretum back in 2021. And one of the purpose about this arboretum is that we want to test the trees, the urban trees, how they behave and how they respond in terms of its growth to this changing climate. So the Bristol site location is a perfect one because the soil is a heavy soil, full sun, exposed to the wind. And it gets really dry as well too. So we are testing them, how drought tolerant they are, how wind resistant they are, how they've been adapting to this changing climate. So we are assessing the growth, not only the standard, the common norm urban forest trees, but also some of the new varieties. And we've been partnering with some of the wholesale growers in the nation. And we've been testing some of those new introductions as well, too, and figuring out how they've been responding to our region, you know, to this type of changing climate as well. So we got about 200 trees right now in ground, and which has a lot of different varieties and a lot of different species and in different genus as well. So, yes, it's about 1 mile loop. And you can take a walk and look into those trees. And the other important thing about those trees is that one section is completely with maples, the other section is alternating to maples. So we've been planting a lot of maples, and we want to encourage homeowners to think beyond maples, because we don't want to repeat the same history that we had with the ash trees, you know. Yeah. So we want to diversify urban forests as much as possible.
And I know some of the trees, and it's going to take a while, you've been adding so many trees, but you have the tags on the tree, and you also have QR codes that people can get more information about that tree if they see something they like.
Absolutely. We are still in the progress, you know, as we keep adding it, you know. So the labeling process, you know, it takes at least more than a year for us, because we want to make sure that the tree, you know, survives the winter faster before we add any tags to it. Say, yes, some of the trees from 2021 till about 2024, we have some tags. This spring we planted some bunch of them. And so those things will be getting tagged next year based on the survival. Yeah.
Yeah. Didn't you plant almost 60 trees this spring?
We planted close to almost like 90 trees.
Oh, geez. And I'm kind of intrigued. You're also creating, besides that 1 mile loop, you're kind of going off and creating special alleys. Tell us about the one that you're trying to do with the sequoia.
So we created two lanes or two alleys that you say, which are right next to the mound. We have couple of mounds in the arboretum. So it's like we want to create a loop around the mound. So we did actually a couple of them. One of the mound, you know, we hosted some of living fossil trees, so where people can walk around and see some of the trees that are ancient trees that lived from the era of dinosaurs that didn't change its genetic characteristics, from ginkgo, bald cypress, including giant sequoias, you know, we planted. We had the sequoia for 2 years in our nursery bed. It survived the winter. So this is the first time we planted it, actually, in that section of the arboretum. We'll see how it's going to grow. So that is one section of the trail that actually talks about a living fossil tree. There is another section of the trail that actually we're testing all the Dutch elm disease-resistant elm trees. There are a lot of different varieties of elm trees, you know. And so we have a elm plantation right now, I would say, in that aisle. In that way, we can know, actually, we can try to bring back some of the, you know, elm trees, you know, urban landscape.
And you also have a section of ornamental type trees and shrubs too, right?
We do have a dwarf ornamental garden right next to the vegetable area, right across the vegetable garden. And say, you know, the whole purpose is about the dwarf woody one, not only for aesthetic perspective, but a lot of time many landscapers as well as homeowners do want to have a low maintenance type of yard. At the same time, they want to see look more pretty. So we do have some of the dwarf woody ones, including some Japanese maples, some of the dwarf conifers, and that are very slow growing, that doesn't require that much of pruning. And at the same time, they look so beautiful. So we have that section of dwarf woody ornamental collections as well, too.
So if some of the, we just have a couple of minutes left, but if people have some existing small trees in their yard, for instance, I have a serviceberry tree that's about 25 to 30 years old, and it's starting to be not so great. Is it possible to remove that tree and then within the year replace it with a different tree, or do you have to wait a certain amount of time?
Well, first of all, figure it out, you know, what went wrong with the serviceberry tree, you know. Serviceberry trees, they are more of pot-shaded, they prefer pot-shaded to full sun. And they take a while for them to establish. So initially when you plant them, they're going to simply sit in the ground without any show of any new growth, you know, at least for 2 or 3 years. Once after that, then they will be able to establish itself. Now, figure out what went wrong with the tree. And if you decided actually to get rid of it and plant something else, plant a total different species there, just in case you don't want to actually invite whatever the disease that may have affected the serviceberry, want again the same disease affecting the same species. So plant something more different. And before you do plant it, check the site location is suitable for that new tree. Call the Diggers Hotline before you do plant them.
Thanks so much, DJ. I can't believe we're out of time already, and we probably just touched a little bit of your knowledge base. But again, go to the UW Extension site and start asking questions through that method. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
We've been talking with VJ Pandian, horticulture educator for Racine and Kenosha County's Office of University of Wisconsin Division of Extension. If you have a lawn or garden question, please go to the UW Extension sites for either Kenosha or Racine County. Their addresses are almost alike except for the words Kenosha or Racine. https://kenosha.extension.wisc.edu. And you would substitute Racine, of course, for Kenosha if you're looking for Racine. Please choose horticulture from the menu at the top. And of course, one of the easier ways is to just search for UW Extension. I'd like to thank you for joining us today. I'm Jane Herring for Community Matters.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.
WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.